You're listening to Valley Edition. Buck Owens was one of the giants of country music, helping to define a rough-and-ready sound that will forever be linked with the city that Owens called home, Bakersfield. While Owens died in 2006, his legacy lives on. Now a new book titled Buckem, the autobiography of Buck Owens, tells his story. It's by Owens, of course, and our next guest, Grammy-nominated producer and author Randy Poe. Randy, welcome to Valley Edition.
Thanks. Great to be here.
How did this project come about?
Well, I had just written a book, or just had a book published called Sky Dog, the Duane Allman story. And I wanted to follow that up with another biography. And I'm based in L.A., and I went up to Bakersfield and met with some of Buck's family and a gentleman named Jim Shaw, who was the keyboard player in the Buckaroos and very involved in Buck's business enterprises there in Bakersfield. And I met them and talked to them about doing an authorized biography of Buck. And we had a great meeting, and after it was over, they took me into Buck's office, just showing me around. They said, and this was Buck's office for many years, and sitting on his desk were these cassette tapes. And Jim Shaw said, oh, hey, these tapes could be helpful to you in your project. And I said, well, what are they? He said, well, back in the mid-90s, Buck was thinking about doing his autobiography, and so every now and then he would record stories about his life on these cassettes, and this is them. And I said, yes, that would be extremely helpful. So I started listening to the tapes, and I got to thinking that it would be a different and better kind of book if we were to take the tapes and turn them into Buck's autobiography, which is what he had originally intended. And so I went back to the family and proposed that option rather than the authorized biography. And they said, by all means, if you can pull it off, then go ahead. And I think maybe we did.
Was it challenging to stay true to Owen's voice in working on this project?
No, not at all. I mean, he has a very distinct voice, and he had a way of telling stories that was very unique to him. And much of what's on the pages of the book came straight off of the tapes.
Digging through all those tapes and all that material had to be fascinating. What surprised you the most in listening to those and learning about Buck? Certainly a huge, huge figure. We all are familiar with his story to some extent, at least here in Central California we are. What surprised you the most?
Well, what surprised me the most was just his incredible photographic memory. I had never known anyone like that before. And, of course, I felt like I really got to know this guy as I sat listening to tape after tape after tape of him telling all these stories. But I was just fascinated at his ability to recall certain events from childhood and every teacher's name and the names of friends when he was 3, 4, 5 years old, the stuff that most humans don't retain, and he kept it all. I mean, he was a very, very bright man. And maybe that was a little surprising since most of us who saw him on TV saw him playing this kind of goofy character on Hee Haw. But this was not a goofy guy at all.
I want to turn to his story now. Like a lot of people who grew up in the Great Depression, Buck knew poverty, and those years left a big imprint on him. Do you think that's part of what drove him in his career, in his business ventures, in his musical ventures?
Absolutely. I think it's what drove his whole life. From the time he was a kid, like you say, I mean, he lived in poverty, and he talks in the book about how he decided when he was very young that he was going to grow up and be somebody, that he wasn't going to live in a world where he had to fix the holes in his shoes with old pieces of linoleum from the kitchen floor, and he wasn't going to have his mother cutting his hair anymore. He wasn't going to have to have hand-me-down clothes and clothes given to him by the local church and those kind of things. He was going to be somebody. He was going to have money. He was going to be successful. Of course, he didn't have a clue how yet or by what means, but that was his intention from the time he was a child.
things really started taking off for him in the early 1950s when he and his young wife moved to California eventually and settled in Bakersfield. What was that like for him, and do you think Buck would have developed differently had he not gone to Bakersfield?
Well, Bakersfield for him was a place with a musical community that was one where the musicians all seemed to look out for each other. Certainly the way Buck tells it, when he got to town, if he needed a guitar, somebody would loan him a guitar. If he needed a nice shirt to wear at a gig, somebody would loan him the shirt. When his guitar broke, the fiddle player fixed it on the spot in a club there in Bakersfield. And there were musicians like Ferlin Husky and Jeannie Shepherd who became successful, had number one hits, and the other people in Bakersfield, rather than feeling jealousy, they were rooting for them because they thought, well, if those two can do it, maybe I can do it too. As far as prior to his moving to Bakersfield, if he'd have stayed somewhere else as a musician around Phoenix, Mesa, Arizona, I think he might have just been a guy playing in a bar band all his life. I think it would have probably been something else that he did in addition to whatever he ended up becoming successful at, because he was definitely going to be successful.
The title of the book, Buckham, refers to not only his name, but also his attitude towards the establishment, whether it's the country music establishment or the music industry itself, the way that the business worked, or at least used to work. Buck was an innovator in both of those fields. Talk about his relationship with Nashville and the established country music hegemony of the day. What was that like, and did it change at all over the years, or did he always maintain that, I guess you could say, resentment towards the power brokers in Nashville?
Well, the way that things were based there, you were expected, if you were going to be a country singer, you were expected to live in Nashville, you were expected to record in Nashville, you were expected to sign with the Nashville division of the record label, even if the record label was based in New York or L.A., you were expected to sign with the Nashville music publisher, you were expected to have a booking agent who was based in Nashville, and your personal manager needed to be based in Nashville. And Buck had no interest in any of that. Buck liked being in Bakersfield. Buck got a recording contract with Capitol Records so he could go down to L.A. a couple hours away to record and then go back up to Bakersfield, which is where his headquarters were. And he had no interest in that whole scene that was going on in Nashville. He wasn't interested in using their studio musicians. He wanted to use his own band, which was just unheard of at that time. And so he did everything his own way. He had his own publishing company, hired his own personal manager to come live in Bakersfield and work. The two of them work out of Bakersfield together. And so everything that Nashville was doing, Buck was doing his own version of it on the other side of the country. And his anger and resentment stemmed from the fact that those power brokers in Nashville therefore concluded he's not really a country singer, because if he was a country singer, he'd be living here doing things the way we tell him to. And so he was ignored by those organizations that were giving out awards to country singers. And it hurt him and it angered him, and he's continually just proved them wrong by having number one hit after number one hit, even though they paid no attention to him.
If you just joined us in Valley Edition, our guest today is Randy Poe. He is the co-author of a new book called Buckham, the autobiography of Buck Owens. It's based on hundreds of hours of recordings that Buck Owens made about his life story. Of course, the musical side of his innovations are well documented, and I think appreciation for them has even grown more since his passing. Buck was also an innovator in his business empire as well, owning radio stations, his publishing company, as you mentioned, really ahead of his time when we think of the way that artists are operating today and seeking more control over their creative output.
Oh, yes, he was decades ahead of his time, for sure. The thing that was most unique that he did was his deal in 1971, I believe it was, where he was able to negotiate a new agreement with Capitol Records, in which when that deal expired, his masters would come back to him, but not just the masters from that particular contract, but all the masters he'd ever recorded for Capitol going all the way back to the 50s. And so today, Buck Owens Enterprises owns all of those master recordings that Buck made for Capitol.
Definitely an innovator there. You mentioned earlier people who grew up watching Buck Owens on television on Hee Haw have a certain image of the man and maybe even of his music, and how that might not be exactly the best image of Buck. You look back on some of those TV shows now and they seem rather corny. Did he reflect back on that decision to stay on Hee Haw and what that meant for his career?
Yes, it was one of those things that he had mixed emotions about. We have to put it in a bit of a perspective, which is when he started, the whole premise was we're going to bring country music to the masses of America who've never heard country music and who've never heard of Buck Owens. So that part was good for Buck. And the negative parts were really obvious really quickly. The first reviews that came out called him a buffoon, which hurt him deeply. But the reason he couldn't pull the plug and say, I'm not going to do this anymore, is because he was getting paid $400,000 a year in 1960s money and 1970s to go down to Nashville for a couple of weeks twice a year and record all of his stuff for the show. And then the show would be edited later to create the 26 episodes for the season. And so it was so little work and such huge money. I mean, we're talking about the equivalent of around $3 million a year today, that he couldn't bring himself to say, no, please stop writing those checks for me.
Moving on to some of his personal relationships, the death of his longtime right-hand man, Don Rich, in the mid-1970s in a tragic motorcycle accident had a profound effect on Buck. Did he ever really get over that? That really changed him, didn't it?
Yeah, it changed him permanently. It's not something he got over. I can sort of understand it, especially when you hear the tapes. This was someone who was about the most important permanent figure in Buck's life. They had known each other since Don was a teenager. And musically, they were a perfect fit. Don's harmony vocals and Don's guitar work, as Buck himself said, was as much as Buck Owens' sound as Buck Owens was. And a few years ago, there was an anthology of Don Rich's work that came out. And Buck wrote a little thing at the beginning of that where he said, just plain as day, I never got over Don's death. That I tried to keep going and keep making music, but after he died, the fire was gone. He certainly had his comeback with Dwight Yoakam and made some more recordings, but things were not the same for Buck personally or musically after Don passed away.
Another relationship that Buck talks about in the book is the one that he had with Merle Haggard, a fellow legend of the Bakersfield sound, a complex relationship, though not the least of which with Bonnie Owens, who was first Buck's wife and then later Merle's wife. Tell me about that relationship and what Buck felt towards Merle.
One of the old wives' tales in the country music world was always, hey, you know, Merle stole Buck's wife away from him. And nothing could be further from the truth. Buck and Bonnie Owens had been divorced for several years when Merle came along, and the two of them became an item. They ended up all three being friendly to one another, and Buck, you know, didn't care who Bonnie was married to anymore. But the actual relationship between Buck and Merle, I think, was so complex because Buck had his own publishing company and signed Merle to his publishing company. So there was a business relationship there where every time Merle was making money, Buck was making money too. So that's always a little complicated with any relationship. And I think it was a case of they both wanted to like each other. I mean, it's really funny, but Buck says, you know, I tried really hard to be Merle's friend, but I just don't know if he really wanted me to. And he says, but the funny thing is, if you ask Merle the same thing about me, he'd probably have the same response. I do know that towards the very end of his life, Buck wrote a letter to Merle talking about how much, you know, Merle had meant to him. So I know that it's something that Merle was very proud to have happen. They were the last of those giants of the Bakersfield scene, and I know that there had to be some love between the two of them, as hard as it might have been for them to express.
Our guest today on Valley Edition has been Randy Poe. He is the co-author of the new book, Buckham, the autobiography of Buck Owens, a posthumous autobiography based on hundreds of hours of cassette tapes that the late country music icon made at his office in Bakersfield, telling his story. It's available wherever better books are sold. Randy Poe, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.